Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do.
Thank you for tuning in to episode 4 of Off the Table. My name is Paul, and today Emily and I are excited to have Dr. Brett Batchelor on the podcast. He is a family physician with enhanced surgical skills in Revelstoke, champion of remote presence technology, and the creator of the Really Rural Surgery podcast. Welcome, Brett.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored.
Hi, Brett. Nice to have you.
Yeah.
So, Brett, just to start off, tell us a little bit about you, where you grew up, what made you decide to become a general practitioner with enhanced surgical skills, and what you like about this profession.
So I grew up in Oliver, BC. I went to UVic initially in my first year in philosophy, and I came back a little bit wondering whether or not that's the type of job I wanted. And my stepdad that my mom had just met like a year before that was a doctor in Oliver, and he was a GP surgeon back when they used to call them that. And he was like, hey, do you want to come see what I do for a living? And I was like, sure. And this was back when you didn't have to like go through UBC and all that other stuff. So we just kind of went to the hospital, walked around the emerge with him. My stepdad is one of the most charismatic people on the planet. So, and he'd been doing it for 35 years. So usually he'd walk into a room and he'd know what he was going to do medically within a minute. So the other 9 minutes, he'd just be chatting with people about farming and this and that and their hobbies. And I'm like, so Bill, basically you walk around and just shoot the breeze with people all day long? He's like, no, it's a bit more than that. But I was like, oh my goodness. And I was like, oh, I think I should be a doctor. But at that time, you know, as I went through the whole process of medical training and stuff, the concept of a GP surgeon, though they existed, it was kind of, there was no formal training program anymore. There wasn't really one way back in the day when he went through it. It was just more interest-based when they had more of a PGY system where you could actually do these type of things early. So in my family medicine training program and the rural program through Kelowna, I went to Revelstoke and then went to Vanderhoof, both of which had ORs there. And I was thinking about doing GPA work because at that time they did have a training program for GP anesthetists. And I just really loved the environment in an operating room. It was just great. But I always knew I wanted to live in a small town and work in a small town. And then when I was in Vanderhoof, I would be in the OR and I would usually start the anesthetic and then go assist with the surgeries and just do both the whole time I was there. And while I was there, one of the doctors there was like, do you want to learn how to do endoscopy? And I was like, yes, that would be great too. Sure, why not? And so at the end of that 4 months, they were like, you know, we don't have an official program to train anybody to do this, but we're getting old and we don't have anybody to replace us. And they had a wonderful hospital and it was such a great system there. And they're like, do you want to give it a go and see what happens? And I was like, yes, just let me talk to my wife. So I talked to my wife. She was training as a teacher at the time. So she realized she could get work in that region. So I went there for a couple of years, trained under them for a while. And then an R3 did end up finally formally getting set up for enhanced surgical skills. And then I went out to Saskatchewan and did that program.
That's awesome. I actually also feel that being a doctor, a lot of it is just meeting people and being social and like learning really cool things about like awesome, like lifetimes. And like, it's really interesting, your story. And also, you're really a pioneer of one of those training programs. And you're basically like a GP with anesthesia and surgical skills, like a GPAS.
I didn't actually get the anesthetic part of it. I just went for the surgical thing. Eventually, when they told me that they could train me for surgery, I was like, that's what I want to do. I just didn't know it existed. So I'm in.
That's awesome. For the listeners on our podcast who are not familiar with ESS training, we know there's not a lot of those programs all over the world. So can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned it briefly, but like the history and the premise behind this training program, where it takes place and where those physicians work all across Canada?
Yeah, so for any of us that went through the rural family medicine programs, we usually ended up encountering these small operating rooms in which they had GP surgeons and GP anesthetists. So from our perspective, those guys were great. And it really created such a wonderful addition to these small towns to be able to do that much more when they were there. Namely, especially allowing people to deliver their babies close to home instead of having to travel. So prior to this, a lot of the training was done by learning from somebody or going through your PGY and learning a few skills and going out there. But, you know, for seeing these different sites and realizing, you know, compared to other small rural sites, how well serviced they were, and just seeing these doctors that were really very, very capable. You know, I think the younger generation, as we were coming through these things, realized that for this to be sustainable, it needs to be formalized in some way. And it's never really has been formalized. It is a reasonably controversial thing and had been for a long time, namely because usually just a lack of knowledge on the part of the specialist, understanding like, what is your scope of practice? What do you do? And because it wasn't formalized, everybody would give a different answer, and it made for kind of more difficult conversations and a bit of a lack of understanding. So there used to be a training program in Alberta that was quasi-formalized, and then Dr. Haynes and a couple other people worked in Saskatchewan, because that's where she was located at the time, to create a really formal program. And in the first 3 to 4 years, as we went through it, we really formalized it under the CanMed stuff from the College of Family Practice, as well as a lot of the learning principles from the Association of General Surgeons in Canada, in terms of their concepts of training. So we ended up creating a modular program that has mostly summative evaluation in it. And you basically get these OSATS forms as you go through, and it's a constant evaluation as you start out and you do your first procedure and your second one and your third one. You just keep on going and going and going. And you can see that evaluation improving over time as you go through the practice. And eventually on those forms, it, you know, one of the final questions is, do you think this person is capable of doing this procedure now? And then people would eventually do that. So in the training program, you can see people kind of develop over time. So that's kind of how the ASS is gone. We've went to a million different meetings over the last 10 years, really formalizing it, making connections with people like yourself overall, really just to kind of share the knowledge and share the creation of the concept and really, you know, connect with people that previously weren't connected with before. So now we have a lot of people with interest in it, not only just the people doing the training, but in addition to that, we you know, liaise with a ton of different specialists who help us continue evolving the program, not only just the educational part of it, but also the networks that we sit in and we constantly work in every single day.
Well, before you ask you this question, I just wanted to know about, I know you guys work in Revelstoke and there's a few other of you guys in BC and Alberta. Do you know about the rest of Canada? Are those physicians also working in eastern provinces, for example?
Yeah, I think we have a listserv of like email lists on people with the various breadth, and it's probably there's around 150, I think, approximately people that would identify themselves as ESS, or the other term is OSS. So there's people that just do C-sections and things related to maternity care, versus the ESS stream, which is like that plus all of the other surgical procedures that we do.
Thanks. As you mentioned before, you work in Revelstoke, BC. Could you tell us a little bit about kind of this community, your hospital, surgical capacity, and some of the geographical challenges you guys face for accessing higher levels of care?
Yeah, so Revelstoke's a very interesting place. A lot of people know about it now because it's a big giant ski hill and lots of tourists. It's a very interesting place to work because our nearest referral center for trauma specifically is Kamloops, which is 2.5 hours away. It's very, very steep mountains. It's shaped like this and therefore not easy to fly into it because it has, I think, the same annual precipitation as Vancouver does. It's just packed into like the winter months. So we get tons of snow, and that Highway 1, the Carnage Highway, it closes a lot. So we get into a lot of situations in which we need to get people out because they come and break themselves on the ski hill, or they break themselves on the road getting to the ski hill, and we can't really get them out. So it is a bit of a challenge in that regard, because transport is probably one of the biggest issues. And I think the role of the surgeon or the GP surgeon or GP ESS doctor, along with the GPA, is really you know, for that purpose in the trauma bay. And we now have like a trauma call. We finally formalized that a couple of years ago with the help of Dr. Haynes, who pretty much spearheads everything that we do. And, you know, previously it would be the eMERGE doc. And if they thought they would need somebody, they would call out the GP surgeon or the GP anesthetist. Now we just get automatically called, just like in the bigger centers. So we all show up there. The GPA has a tendency usually to manage the airway. You know, the GP ESS doc, for a lot of times it's doing the procedures. So it's the chest tubes, it's the reductions, it's the splinting and stuff like that. And the eMERGE doc then gets to continue on with their work in terms of the overall picture, stabilizing the patient, arranging transport and stuff like that. So it really works incredibly well. Like, I feel so fortunate to be able to work in a system in which I have that backup, not only when I'm working eMERGE, but also doing the surgical part of things too. So yeah, that's kind of Revelstoke in a nutshell.
I visited your hospital a few years ago. I was skiing in steep mountains and I was hanging out with Vicky, and I really love your aura. I'm actually very jealous. It's super state of the art. You guys have everything you need there.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a wonderful group of people too. Like the nurses, they're the same nurses. There's like six or seven of them. We're just basically a team that constantly works together, helps each other out.
What would you say, Brett, if you needed like specialist care, especially in surgery, like you would be lacking the most in Revelstoke? Like, is there anything specific that you as a GPESS can't do and we need help from outside?
You know, we're pretty well covered. Like, we're not the only people who do surgery here electively. Like, we have a number of visiting specialists that come. Arranging that is kind of based a lot on tradition, but also based on need in the community. So for example, 2 years ago, we started doing ACLs, mainly because when I'm working at eMERGE and it's the middle of the winter, we probably get around three or four people who need ACL surgery a day from skiing and wrecking their knees. Yeah, it's amazing. Like, I stopped skiing because of the ACL injuries I saw. I only snowboard now because snowboarders usually don't get injured unless they hit something.
What about their wrists?
Yeah, well, if you're learning it. But like, you know, a lot of people with the ACLs, it's just they're good skiers and they weren't doing anything crazy. They were like just caught an edge as they're going towards a chairlift, and it just, that big lever arm on the ski just rips their knees open. So, you know, a lot of it goes around planning in that regard. So we have a number of visiting surgeons who come and do a number of different procedures, and we slowly add to that over time. I think here we've increased our capacity from 3 days to 4 days in the last 5 years with the RSON, which is the Rural Surgical and Obstetrical Networks program. So yeah, I wouldn't say we're really lacking at this point. I think we're, you know, we're one of those sites that we spend a lot of time doing a lot of pilot projects, as you know, as with we did with you with the simulations and the remote telepresence. So I think we're, you know, we're very well served here. And I think it's probably because we are all very dedicated to it and spend a lot of time on that organization piece.
Yeah, that's really awesome to hear. And I agree, like sometimes working in a small team actually makes it much more efficient. And you guys have the perfect setup there. Just looking more broadly a little bit, I know you did some work in sub-Saharan Africa, and I was wanted to ask you, what do you think, like such a model, like the GPESS model, the like enhanced surgical skills model, how can that, and can that be applied to low-income countries, low-resource setting type of areas, and what has been your experience working in that setting in that regard?
Yeah, I'm actually going in again in a couple of weeks now. Actually, exactly 14 days, I'll be going back to Ghana to do work there.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always wanted to do that. I never wanted to do the experience where they just toss me into a hospital and I just kind of run around like a chicken with my head off and do stuff that I don't really know how to do. So I spent a lot of years kind of contemplating it and talking it to people about it. And Ray Markham, who's the head of the Rural Coordination Center of British Columbia, I spent some time talking to him when I was up in Vanderhoof because he's from Vail Mount. And his big thing is the concept of capacity building, which is wonderful, but very difficult to do. It's the concept of, instead of going and doing primary service for people, you go down and you try to build that capacity by either teaching or structurally do things. So the first time I went down to Zimbabwe in 2017, you know, it was really interesting, that experience there. I was supposed to go down and help teach hernias or inguinal hernias. And then that kind of, there was malaria and floods in the area. I was going to do it and that fell apart. So I ended up going over and doing exactly what I hadn't planned on doing, which is getting thrown into a hospital and doing a whole bunch of stuff like that. But while I was down there, I really learned a lot about the capacity building and basically how much it's related to a long-term relationship with people and commitment to continuing going down. So when I went to Ghana, it was a very different thing. Ghana, we went, there was a guy who reached out on the listserv to the ESS doc saying, hey, I've been going down for 25 years and basically doing hernias for 3 weeks twice a year. Is anybody interested? And a lot of us were like, me, 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 me. It wasn't capacity building, but I really wanted to try the two different experiences. And we went down there and, you know, it was very interesting because we did primary service. We did, you know, I think we did 181 inguinal hernias in 3 weeks, the three or four doctors that were there. It was very rewarding work in and of itself. You know, you see these things that you can't measure. Like we get these young 23-year-old guys with these giant hernias. They can't work and they haven't for a while. They're supposed to be the breadwinner for their family. They can't afford the surgery itself down there. We do the surgery and suddenly, you know, around 6 weeks, they get back into the workforce. So it does have these kind of long lasting effects, but they're, you know, looking at all the studies, it's really hard to measure those things. We do want to work on the capacity building formally as the group of ESS doctors now, but, you know, just seeing Earl, the guy that was from Wawa in Ontario, who's been doing this for 25 years, you know, the capacity building, when you go into a same place over and over and you build those relationships, capacity building happens and it happens very organically, right? Like we're all still in contact with that clinic. That clinic sometimes has various needs that we can sometimes meet abroad now with the communications back and forth. Sometimes they need help trying to find a specific piece of equipment to continue being able to do what they're doing or something else like that. And we're able to do that. And really the cornerstone of it is that we go down and we do something that we're capable of doing, that we feel comfortable of doing, that we don't burn ourselves out doing it. And therefore we go back. Like I have now have a plan to go back every year for until the end of my career in some capacity. It's really hard when you go down, you get thrown into stuff you don't know what to do. You come back like, you know, feeling like I did something and that was pretty hardcore. But a lot of those people, when you ask them, are you going to go back? They're like, well, I don't know. You know, you can tell it was really stressful for them. So, you know, for the ESS doctor to get back to their question, we do get a lot of requests because, you know, as you know, in surgery, like specifically laparoscopic surgery. So a lot of people are used to doing those surgeries. I had somebody on my podcast and he was in a training program for general surgery in Ontario and they don't teach a regular appendectomy anymore. Like they do them all laparoscopically. So a number of surgeons have gone down and they're like, I need this piece of equipment because that's what they use that they trained on, you know, and they're like, we don't have it. And they're like, what do you have? And they're like, we got this knife and a fork. And they're like, oh my goodness, it kind of gets them a little bit stressed. Whereas I think as an ESS doctor, we're often used to, like the rural doctors are often used to, like, you know, we don't have the equipment that the bigger centers, you know, the specialist asks us when we're on the phone, do you have this thing? And we're like, we don't have this thing, but we find alternatives all the time. So I think also because a lot of the procedures we do are the very basic ones in which they are open procedures. And they're not really crazy stuff. There's a lot of those things that need to be done out there and we're able to kind of serve that in a way.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I find that there's a very deep synergy between the work that you do and what a surgeon in the deepest rural place in sub-Saharan Africa has to deal with every day. And you have to be resourceful. You know, you can't ask for fancy tools all the time. I just want to go back on something that you said that was interesting about how the relationship evolves organically and how you found that eventually, despite this relationship starting with a service delivery type of model in Ghana, you said you just went to do a few hernia repairs. So that was not really built as a capacity building project, but you eventually built capacity by maintaining that relationship and eventually that people over there were asking for things that you could provide and just that's how it grew. My question is, do you think we always talk about proper needs assessment and making sure that we actually provide or, you know, respond to a need that's brought up by the local physicians or healthcare providers or surgeons? But do you think it's more important to build a strong and, you know, bilateral relationship with those communities and those settings than actually do like an exact and thorough needs assessment to really figure out what's missing and how you can help? Like where should we put our energy when we're building those relationships?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, right? Where do you start? I would say that those relationships are probably like, as you probably have traveled other places, right? Like you really don't know until you're there for a while what the real true scene is. Like it was interesting in Ghana. I went from Tamale to Mole, which is their national park there. And I was driving along the road and the number of empty buildings that had like Canada, even there was some from Canada, Canada's school for the, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's empty and there's a Land Cruiser in the front. And then they're like, there's the Dutch one. And then there's this one and that one all over there. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, we have the best interests in, and we have the best, you know, goals at heart when we go down and we're going to, you know, we get some funding and we say, we really want to help somebody, you do needs assessment and stuff like that. And talking to a lot of the doctors down there, like, they're like, it happens all the time. People come in, they get funding, they have like the, our best interests at heart, but they're, it's time limited. They got 2 years and they got funding that lasts for 2 years. It's supposed to carry over to us, but they feel a crunch and stuff like that. A lot of people, they come down, they've never been here. They haven't spent a lot of time here. They don't know how this country works. And they, you know, every different country is so individual that, you know, the reason why Earl does a lot of capacity building, even though he's not, like, we told him, oh, you do a lot of capacity building. He's like, I've never heard that word before. And we're like, oh yeah, this is a kind of a new thing. But you know, it's really when you start building those relationships, you go to a place over and over again, you really start to feel the ebb and flow. And then from that, like, I wouldn't try to do something formally in Ghana for myself, even though Earl's been doing it for a long time, for probably at least 5 years, because I really want to make sure after seeing all those empty buildings that what I'm doing is not only has the needs assessment that we do formally, but like, I know it's not just the need right now. It's the ongoing need that I see every time I go there every year after year, so that it can be sustainable. And probably the reason that program's sustainable is because the clinic was started by a Ghanaian doctor and it's always been a local thing. They do get donations from other places, but it's always run by Ghanaians. They always say it's by Ghanaians for Ghanaians. And so, because it was started from that premise, it's had a lot of traction and it's continued that traction because there was never limited funding for it. It was always people from there volunteering and they're very proud about it because it came from themselves. So, you know, to me, doing those type of things, I think personally, I like, you know, the whole service oriented thing has become almost a bad word. I don't think it is, right? Like, I think that's a great place to start because we can do that. We can set up our own little mini hospitals, we can do stuff. But while we're doing it and building those relationships, that's when you start to work on that capacity building thing. And you really, you know, it's all about efficiency, right? Like, I want to make sure that the funding and the man hours that we put into this really sticks. And you probably, you're not really going to know that until you're really in a place a long time and really get your mind wrapped around how different it is from the world and the culture of medicine that we live in.
No, that was an awesome response. Thanks. Like, yeah, really, I hadn't thought about it like exactly that way before, but that was a really cool way to frame it. So back in 2014, you started, as I'm sure many of our listeners already know, you started a podcast called Really Rural Surgery and Obstetrics. Can you tell us a little bit about your reason to do so and kind of the process to create and maintain it and how your experience so far has been with that?
Yeah, I think there was two streams to that. One was, you know, we often get questions as family practitioners doing surgery, namely because, again, that lack of what is that whole thing about, like, how do you learn new things? What's your CME like? You know, what are you guys continually upgrading your skills, updating your knowledge and stuff like that? Because it's not like we have like the Journal of General Surgery and we have the Journal of Urology and all that stuff. And because our skills are taken from a number of these things, people are like, how do you keep up to date? And so I was like thinking about it. Also at that time, you know, so it was kind of a personal thing. So I'd gone to Saskatchewan and worked with all these guys and everybody has their own answers based on what they've read, right? So I'd learned all this stuff. And then I went back to Vanderhoof and I brought this stuff back and I'm like, I went to the city and I learned all this stuff and it's all new and you guys don't know what you're doing. And then they're like, oh yeah, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, how do you know that? And I'm like, 'cause they told me. And I'm like, did you look at the research? And I'm like, that's a good question. No, I haven't. So it actually came from, you know, coming back there and being a snotty guy that like went to the city and learned all these fancy things and having some skepticism on the side of like Lucas, who is the guy that I trained under mostly when I was in Vanderhoof. And he's just one of the best guys. He just took the best things from everybody he'd seen, and he's often right. And I'm like, maybe you're not right anymore, Lucas. I'm going to go look this stuff up, and I'm going to do a podcast, and I'm going to answer these questions. So it came out of that. And at the same time, I started listening to The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, and it was such an awesome format for a podcast. It's basically, they're like, we have a clinical question. We want to find the currently, from our perspective at least, what is the best actual primary paper or meta-analysis that this comes from? Because there's a lot of stuff in surgery where it's very specific, right? It's like, do you close scarpa's fascia at an inguinal hernia, right? And it debates this, and you know, there's always, people heard about this paper 12 years ago, so they kind of quote it, but are they quoting it correctly? Or are they doing it correctly? So I was like, I want to go down and answer these questions. I want to find those papers and actually analyze them and say, is it good evidence? And it's been really interesting journey, because you know, you realize, as you know, Emily, that a lot of surgical evidence usually has around 100 people in the study, and there's 50 in each arm, and they're not really highly powered. But it's really been interesting, because you find these very small studies that have changed medicine globally, and it kind of blows my mind. Mm-hmm. So that was the premise of it. It was just really a lot of curiosity. And in addition, you know, from my own perspective, I remember a lot of that information now, maybe because I'd spend 2 to 3 hours on each podcast episode trying to get the bibliography, read through all the abstracts, find the one that I kind of like the most, and then actually go from there. And so it really sticks in my head. So I actually remember it. So there's a bit of a selfish component to it.
But do you know what the reach of your podcast is in terms of like the types of people who listen to it, where they're located, and how many listeners you have?
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't actually get that information, because it goes, so everything went through Apple. Now, I guess it's Apple Music now. So all podcasts were basically, you have this, it's this weird thing where you have it exists somewhere on the internet, and it's linked through Apple, and then all of the other kind of podcast apps and stuff like that search through Apple to find those things. So they're all connected back to Apple, and Apple doesn't give new metrics. Google will actually give you your metrics on your actual website when people have clicked it and stuff like that. So it's really like kind of strange. You don't really know. And on Facebook, I like post the podcast episode, and sometimes I get like 40 people have reached it. And if I have the right keywords there randomly, I get like 700 people. But when I was getting my Google statistics, I actually was like really quite surprised. It's people all around the world. And I was like, are you real, or are you bots listening to my podcast? And then it was interesting. That's how I ended up with my co-host, is that, I think I've mentioned this before in the podcast, you know, there was somebody in Knoxville, Iowa, like every month, because I looked at it every month, there was somebody with an IP address at Knoxville, Iowa. And I was like, that is a real person. That's not a bot kind of randomly clicking on the internet. So I was like,
well, that's how you found him. Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, I know there's somebody in Knoxville, Iowa listening to this show. Can you email me? Cause I'd like to know who you are. And so David Kermode is a general surgeon down in Iowa that worked in the university hospital in Des Moines, or they call it Des Moines there. Yeah, I know.
It's terrible. They don't know it's a French word.
They do know it's a French word. They're like Des Moines, Des Moines or whatever. I can't even pronounce it the way they pronounce it, because it just in my head, it automatically goes to the French. Anyways, he turned out to be a real guy. He's an awesome dude. He was actually helping start an equivalent ESS program down in the States, because they were having the same problem. He was a general surgeon. He worked in these small towns in the States. General surgeons don't want to work in small towns anymore, so they were losing all these services. There was still family doctors down in the kind of Midwest states that were doing these extra skills and stuff. And they're like, we want a formal program too, because we need to service these communities. And so they've actually built one down there based on our ESS thing. I was like, you can just copy our whole thing. That's cool. Like, go for it. You know, change what you want. We did a whole bunch of work. We had all these modular stuff. Go for it. And then, yeah, I know we've developed a close friendship. And then one day I was like, I kind of don't want to do this alone. I'd rather have somebody be my co-host. So I asked him, and now he's like totally into it like I am, which is really good. Yeah. So that's a good example of it. You know, we can't really estimate it, but it is, I do get emails and stuff from all over the world from people that listen to it. So it's got to be out there somewhere.
No, that's really cool. I didn't realize that was how you found Dr. Kermode. Like, and it's fun, like, I don't know if you guys have met in person or not, but your chemistry on the podcast is awesome. So that's pretty funny that it just worked out that way.
Yeah, he told me he liked the jokes. I was like, come on, I'm giving education here. It's not just jokes. Yeah, it's actually, we have met because he's come to a lot of our conferences. So every 2 years we have this conference in Banff that we might get Emily and you know, your folks to come and talk at. Have we had you guys talk here? I think
I came.
You did. Once. Yeah.
Harvey has come too. Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, David's been at that one every couple of years. He comes up and enjoys a little time in Banff. So it's pretty cool.
More on the podcast, on your most recent episode, you kind of opened up speaking about some of the experiences you had over the last little while. And one of the things you talked about was your experience using remote learning to teach suturing skills, which sounds like it was a huge success. What are your hopes kind of with this in both the near and far future for the expansion of kind of remote learning to reach and teach more rural communities? Like what are you working on next kind of with this?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, the history of that. So my mom was a teacher and she's like, I was like, maybe I should become a teacher. She's like, don't become a teacher. I'm like, but what if I want to become a teacher? She's like, become the librarian. I was like, why didn't you become the librarian? Like, she's like, because it's quiet and they get the technology. And she's like, nobody wants to deal with the technology because it's so nerdy. But she's like, it's always at the forefront of teaching. And so if you get that job in teaching, you will, you know, have security and stuff like that. You'll always be doing something on the forefront of stuff. So when the RSON project, the rural surgical obstetric network project that's now in its fourth year started, they had a pillar of it, and we called them pillars, of remote presence technology. And it was this concept of like one of the big gaps we have, and we've worked on this with Emily and the team a lot, and it's been wonderful, is, you know, I can probably think of like maybe three times in my career where I really wish somebody was in the room with me looking at what I looked at, because you get surprised sometimes, right? You go to a lab app and you're like, what is that? Right. And then you're trying to explain it over the phone. And like, you know, back in the day, we tried to like hold an iPhone up with Skype and it just was so terrible. So the concept was, you know, can we get very high definition views from a specialist somewhere in what we're doing? So if we do need to walk through something that we haven't seen before, or even say, hey, you know, like that happens in surgery, there's a thing, I've never seen this thing. What's this thing, right? People can see it on their end. So we ended up getting this really fancy machine from InTouch, a company down in Santa Barbara. It had two cameras on it. It had one that was a regular one, one on a boom arm, and it had the ability on the other end as the person actually, you know, sitting in and looking in at the room, capability that they could control the camera themselves. They can zoom in to a level in which they can actually see the surgical field better than the people doing the surgery because of the high definition, the zoom in there. So, you know, we've started working on that. We worked on that a lot, tried to get all these sites, this remote connection. And then, you know, the suture thing came up because now that I end up being the librarian, I get asked a lot of this stuff. They're like, we want to do something. We really wanted to have the rural conference this year. Usually we do the suturing workshop, you know, advanced, you know, the small techniques for family doctors that are working rurally. And they're like, do you guys, is there a way you can do this remotely? And I was like, probably. So because Zoom has changed things and everything like that, and we have webcams and stuff like that, I was like, let's just give it a go like it's a cooking show, right? You know, like you have those ones on Facebook where you see the person is the bowl and they're like doing all this stuff and like the lettuce goes in and everything and you just see that. I'm like, we could probably do that on our thing. We'll just get the models and have people bring their own and over the thing, try to explain it on there and give it to go as a pilot project. Yeah, apparently it worked really well. You know, there was a few things where like my camera was maybe a little bit high. It could have been lower. I was in a hotel room in Vancouver at the time because I just finished teaching another course at VGH. And I had like draped the camera off of a lamp that was on the desk in the hotel room to get it dangling at the right height, kind of sitting there. I'd like clipped it on and stuff like that. Yeah, it worked out really well. So, you know, I'd love to, when I'm in the back of my mind as I've gone through all this process, I think a lot about places like Africa and stuff like that. And like Africa amazingly has one of the best 3G networks anywhere. Like I frequently talk to my family on my phone and I like FaceTime them or do the equivalent from home. And I'm like, wow, if you could get a bit better of a bandwidth, we could be teaching people all over the world, right? And not only that remote presence technology thing, like I probably could phone Kevin Wiseman when I'm doing a hernia in Africa. He's like my general surgeon coach guy from Vernon. When I'm there, so long as he's not sleeping, I probably could show him stuff with the technology we have currently. So increasing that capacity would be really nice, because I think there's a lot of times where people in Africa are doing things that are probably a little bit over their heads even, and to be able to connect them with surgeons around the world so that they could do the same thing that we're trying to do with the trauma team, right? Like, I don't know what this is. I'm going to go on here. It'd be amazing to have a network and somebody in remote Ghana who's doing a surgery and finds something, gets connected with maybe like a surgeon in France who's just randomly on that call and is able to talk them through that. Like, that's big, big picture. But I think these things are doable. So I think I'd like to be able to take some of the stuff that I'm doing now in this regard in Canada, where it's really easy to organize things, and eventually kind of apply it to places that have higher need and lower resources.
Well, that was actually beat my next question, because I was going to ask about that. We do have a partnership. UBC has a partnership right now with MSF France in South Sudan. So we're running an essential surgical skills program in Awil, which is a northern city in South Sudan. And it's a very peaceful place, which is great, because it's a really good place to actually run a training program. But long story short, the big gap here is to get basically surgical instructors to teach your surgical skills to those GPs. So like that piece, like that telementoring piece and like teleteaching and being able to like do those skills, like with pretty like minimal technology, as you've described, it seems pretty simple. Would be really great to teach them skills that they don't often do. So, and I'm sure you've had that experience when you went to Ghana and Zimbabwe, like most physicians there know the basic surgical skills. They're pretty good at draining abscesses and, you know, but it's stuff that they'll rarely see. So that hospital in Awil, for example, is a pediatric hospital. And so they don't do extensive orthopedic procedures like amputations, for example. And, you know, we're worried that if those physicians get to work in adult hospitals in the future and they're the only surgical provider there and they have to perform a life-saving procedure like that, they won't be able to. So how do we teach those skills that are a little bit more advanced, but still essential in a setting such as South Sudan? Like, I'm sure technology could solve that problem. That's part of the solution.
Yep.
I guess, and I didn't really have a question there.
Yeah. You know, sometimes the hardest part is knowing what technology is available and how much bandwidth you need. Like, it does get a little bit nerdy. Sometimes I usually have the IT guys in interior health and stuff like that walk me through some of that stuff. But as you know, you have a piece of hardware, you have software, and then you have the internet, and you need all those things to be working on both ends to the point where it doesn't start going bleep, 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 and then you lose stuff and everything like that. And so you do have to pick the right hardware and the right system and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it is definitely very doable. And yeah, I'd love to work on that a bit more as time goes along. We'll see what opportunities come up.
Yeah, if you have some openings in your schedule, maybe we should chat separately about this.
We're
always looking for partners. And like I said, this program is very similar to what you're doing already in Revelstoke.
Oh, that'd be really cool.
Awesome.
So if you had to choose kind of one actionable item with a clear time-bound target, something that could advance surgical care in rural Canada, what would it be?
That is a good question.
You can only pick one.
I know you guys wrote this down and I was like, man, I like what can I do? I would really like to actually very simply do the same course we did for the BC rural conference, for the SRPC rural conference, to reach out to more of Canada. We've always found, that course or the equivalent of it has been running for probably like 10 years. It was mostly actually done in Montreal initially through the SRPC. And it was just like, you know, in all surgery, there's always something that's just on the cusp of what you're capable of doing. It's just like the plus one of it, right? And so for GPs doing things like excising moles and stuff like that, there's always like the one up, which would be like creating a small flap to cover it, because, you know, doing an ellipse isn't going to work. So that's what that course is based on. So, you know, I think I would like to do that in a remote sense, or even have it, because next time we do the SRPC conference, which is like the big rural family conference in Canada, I'd like to run that as part of it and have a stream where the people who can't actually make it to the conference themselves can still benefit from the actual workshop itself. So I'd really like to be able to pilot it across provinces and see how far we can get with the internet to be able to have that streaming, to be able to actually get enough clarity with the what we're doing with our hands. You know, other people suggested having two cameras where it's like one is a top-down view and one is a side view, so they can really actually kind of see how your hands are moving in three-dimensional space. So yeah, I think that's probably a reasonably actionable thing, and I think we've already been asked to do it. So there you go. Next year.
Easy win. Can you describe a little bit in more details, Brett, what that course entails? Like, what skills are you teaching in that course? I've never seen it.
So this time, what did we teach? We taught extensor tendon repair with using a modified Kessler suture. It's a surprise one for a lot of people because they're like, well, family doctors from real places can do that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do because there's a couple things that happen. One, the patient's unwilling to travel, and so there's no alternative. Two, there's no surgeon available to do it, and the patient's going to have to wait like 2 to 3 days. And so, you know, when you're working in some rural places, they, like, say, for example, you get this one right here, right? It was back of my head. Yeah. So this one reasonably, or maybe this one, actually, the third one. Sometimes people slice this one and it's like, it's right there. It's open to them. You know, it doesn't take long to actually do that repair when you know how to do it properly and how to do the physio afterwards, the splinting and stuff like that. But that patient, say in Vanderhoof, often had to go down to Vancouver. And, you know, taking somebody out of their community, especially a lot of the First Nations people who don't have the funding to come back because it's a one-way ticket when you travel in BC. You don't get return. So they drop you off. You go down to your wonderful hospital down there, VGH. You see the plastic surgeon. They do the tendon repair and they say, okay, time to go home. And they're like,
book your flights.
How do I get home? And then Greyhound stopped running and there was no bus. And like these patients are like, and they know it. They're like, I'm not going. And you're like, your finger is at risk here and you need that finger. And they're like, well, I can't get down. I can't get back. I'm not going. Or you have people that it's really easy to lose in the follow-up. So they say, you know, in a couple of days, you know, the patient can come down in maybe 2 days. And you're like, if we don't do it now, this patient's definitely not going to get it done. So that was one of them. The other one we did was the proper lips. I did the SRPC this year. I did like my 5 B-side papers. One of them was like that angle at the end of an ellipse that we always said was 30 degrees with the 1-to-4 ratio. Turns out like one of those is wrong. Anyways, it turns out a lot of people wanted to know, like, how do you do these properly? And so Dries taught one of those. Sometimes we do like a VY advancement flap for fingertip injuries, just to be able to cover up that pad that gets exposed and stuff like that. It's a reasonably straightforward one. So, you know, people coming into it, they know we always do like a needs assessment. So we ask, these are the list of procedures that we can teach. Which ones are you interested in? Then we always ask, like, what's your level of experience? So we get people from very different levels there. So yeah, it's very, you know, that's just that kind of one-up stuff from stuff they're already doing.
That's awesome. These sound like master classes. Are these recorded and available for others to see?
Yes.
Not yet.
We recorded that one. Yes. It's somewhere on the internet. But I think you have to have actually participated in the conference to be able to access that thing. I don't have it as a free thing yet. But you know, I think the thing is we've refined the in-person experience. We haven't refined the online, you know, remote experience. Once we refine that, I'll probably be able to actually do it and do it in a way that, you know, I'd love for people to be able to practice that stuff at home. But then they won't come to the conference and then I won't get invited to these cool things. I won't get to meet people anymore.
Awesome. Dr. Batchelor, I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on. Just one last question before we kind of let you go. Who would you recommend we host next on the podcast?
What are the goals of the podcast?
Basically, for the most part, you're actually the first Canadian we've interviewed. For the most part, we've been interviewing doctors practicing in really rural parts of the world. So far, it's been mostly Africa. So we're just trying to kind of educate people and get opinions from all over the world about global surgery, basically.
You should talk to Paul Thistle in Zimbabwe.
I listened to your interview with him. It was awesome.
Man, he is such a unique guy and he has such a great sense of humor. He is a wonderful person to talk to. You should talk to Paul Thistle.
Awesome. We'll definitely reach out to him.
Yeah, Brett, we're really trying to give a voice to people who don't have one. Like, I find like global surgery world right now is just full of, you know, Harvard papers and the Lancet commissioned and sometimes the WHO. And like, this is just really, these are high level documents and commissions and academics who just basically don't change the day-to-day life of surgical providers in, you know, those settings. And even talking to patients who experience that type of surgical care would be really fascinating for us. So we just want to put it out there for the world to know what challenges these communities face, and people like you work in the rural community face too, and how like we can actually come up with like meaningful solutions to close that gap in surgical care.
Well, that is so cool. Good on you guys. That's awesome.
It was awesome to have you, and I get a sense of humor piece. Maybe if we need another co-host, we'll reach out to you.
For sure. Quit my day job.
I don't know how to make this lucrative. Do you have any tips?
I've earned $0 from what I've done so far, so I would not be the person to ask that question.
Because you're not selling t-shirts, Brett.
Oh, like these ones? You get a flowery. Come listen to my episode. You get a free flowery t-shirt.
You get a flowery t-shirt. Well, it was really great to have you, and maybe we'll reach out to, what about the GP anesthetist? Would you know somebody who would work in a rural place that would be interested in talking to us? We would like to have that perspective too.
I always got a couple hanging around here. Kirk McCarroll would be a good guy to talk to.
Cool.
Probably or actually, you know what? Sean Ebert would be a really good guy to talk to because he's done a number of different kind of work, and I think he's gone to South America a few times. And he's a wonderful guy. He was like my total role model in medicine. He's the one who taught me endoscopy because he was a GPA who also did endoscopy. Amazing guy. Yeah, I would talk to Sean. Yeah, I can talk. I can give you his contact information, but he's a great guy to talk to.
Okay. Yeah. Amazing. Sounds awesome.
Awesome, Brett. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Have a good
weekend. Talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_globalsurgery, and Twitter, off the table_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.